Accession number 28498, Reel 3.
David Wright, Reel 3. So what happened when you'd finished with the fighter school at Yorvalton?
Well, you got on leave. That's the first thing, you got on leave. And you await my lords, the commissioners, the Admiralty, to appoint you somewhere. I have no idea. There's a lot of hoo-ha about that. They were all volunteers. Bullshit, they weren't. All I got is a direction to report to Belfast, HMS Caroline, which isn't a ship at all, it's a shore station, Sydenham near Belfast, it's now Belfast City Airport, report then there to relieve Scott. Scott, I didn't know what that meant at all, but Scott was the name of another pilot, and I was supposed to be his relief. And I was just appointed, so I took the boat train from Keighley, where I live, to Heysham and overnight, and reported to 804 Squadron.
And what was unique about 804 Squadron at that time?
Well, at that time, I didn't know anything about it. You know, it's just a number, 804. But, of course, when I got there, I realised there weren't all that many pilots. I was young, very young, 20. I've forgotten, was I 20? I says. And Bob Everett, he was exactly twice my age. He was 40. And he took me under his wing and went flying in Hurricanes, information, and I was his number two. This was fall from Sydenham, Belfast. It's the only time you do fly, of course, when you're shore-based. Really, when you're ship-based, it's very limited, this flying, even an aircraft carrier. Because remember, to fly from an aircraft carrier, the ship has to turn into wind. And it's got a destroyer escort, they've all to turn into wind. And it's a big job, unless you're going to be catapulted off. So there isn't all that much flying compared with the RAF. And so in joining 804 Squadron, I really didn't know much about. I knew it was a catapult ship. I didn't really know about landing on anything. I didn't really... It dawned on me then, bloody hell, you know. It's a question of ditching this. You never practice ditching. So, a lot of apprehension, but it's something new. After all, training is always something new. So, your first operation squad, it's something new. You're not entering a new environment, it's just next stage.
So, you were going to be involved with CAM ships. Can you describe to me the background to what CAM ships are?
Well, they are, the political background. Well, you have to remember the year, this is before America's come into the war. And it's immediately after the Battle of Britain, that's the time. And all England then is depending for its survival on fuel and food coming in ships. Remember, we can't get it from France anyway, it's to come in ships, in convoys of ships. And England was hard-pressed because Focke-Wulf Condors, that's the German military version of the Focke-Wulf Courier, the civil courier, were going out on any sortie that sink at least 5,000 tons of British shipping, at least, on each sortie. Lives were being lost, ships were being lost, and above all, the contents of the ships. I'm talking about oil and you know, the thing that kept, and food that kept England going. And England was being starved. And had it succeeded, had Hitler succeeded, he wouldn't have needed to invade England. It'd have starved England if it could control the sea. And so, after the Battle of Britain, it was Churchill himself, so I'm told, who got the idea and said, if we can defend London successfully with fighter aeroplanes, which in fact they just had proved, why can't we defend convoys with fighter aeroplanes? And that was the trigger, and somebody then invented a catapult. It's not the right word, really, a catapult. A catapult makes you think of elastic, doesn't it? but invented this thing that would fit onto an existing ship that was in a convoy. That's a banana boat. And my particular ship was a banana boat, a Fife's banana boat, called Erin before the war. But then it was became a Royal Naval vessel, was rechristened HMS Maplin. And they fit this metal structure forward of the mainmast, right to the bows, and there was just 70 feet you could get there, length, and it was like a pair of railway lines, that's all. And on the pair of railway lines, there was a metal trolley with four wheels, basically. And on the metal trolley, there were four anchor points for an aeroplane, a Hurricane in this case, mounted, which had been strengthened. The aeroplane's fuselage was strengthened to do it. And it was lowered on. And then when fired off, it had 70 feet to get airborne. Mind you, you have the engine at full revs, and then it needs the assistance of these rockets, and up to 15 rockets, each 11 foot long and 3 inch diameter, let them all at once, virtually. And the thrust from that is enough that your flying speed at the end is 70 feet. Now, 70 feet is only about 3 aeroplane lengths, so there's an enormous G-force, but you're flying at the end. And this was a way of getting a fighter aeroplane into the air to attack Focke Wulf condors in the middle of the Atlantic. In itself, brilliant idea. It didn't shoot down. They didn't shoot down all that many foreigners, actually. But if you shot down a Focke Wulf condor and saved one ship, you've saved how many lives of sailors? And it was worth the loss of one aeroplane and all the food or fuel you've saved. In fact, if it bombed or directed U-boats, you may have saved two or three ships. So loss of a pilot wasn't all that great compared with the loss of the crew of, say, two ships and all the tonnage. So it was a sensible idea, and Churchill had got a winner there, which was a fill gap. And this only lasted, though, very briefly, until America came into the war. When America joined the war, we had what they called Woolworth carriers. Then the aeroplane could get back on board again then. That was basically what a campship was, and what Squadron 804 that I was pointed to, the pilots equipped those campships.
You mentioned these campships were converted. How many campships were converted?
Well, I don't know the real answer to that, but there weren't so many, half a dozen perhaps altogether. Remember that the Fleet Air Arm, they staffed with pilots only one campship, HMS Maplin. And the 804 Squadron only had, I think I once counted, there were no more than 7 pilots, maybe 8 pilots. That's all. The RAF, they call themselves the Merchant Ship Fighter Unit, MSFU. They were based at Liverpool, speak, and they equipped initially perhaps 4 more camp ships, but 2 of them were torpedoed fairly early on. The Navy were the first camp ship and the last camp ship. In the between time, there were about 4 or 5 maximum staffed by the RAF. What I never realised was that why on earth didn't we get to confer? We never met, and we could have learned a lot. Nowadays, you compare notes. We never did.
Did you have to undertake any training with the catapult?
Yes. Remember, this is a rocket catapult. It's a bit unique in its time. But catapulting is an old, dates back to the First War. From gun turrets, spotter planes were sent off the tops of gun turrets, and they were catapulted off to spot the shot of cannon, of battleships' guns on the enemy. But they were shot off with either steam or cordite that drove a sort of a piston to send them off. The camp ships was a raw, like November 5th, it was a rocket, about 11 foot long, 3 inch diameter, and there were up to 15 of them. So that's why I call that little essay I did Airborne Boy Rocket. That didn't happen again until you get to What, Cape Canaveral?
So did you... you did some training at Daedalus, I believe.
Training? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, yes, I've lost it. Training. Well, the first thing, therefore, was... went to Leon Solent, HMS Daedalus is the ship's name, a ground station, where they had a catapult. I'm talking about the piston type, that could catapult a swordfish off, and it was on the aerodrome. Very gentle by comparison. And so we sent down there, and I had, I think, two launches probably on that catapult, just to get the feel of getting airborne quickly. And it didn't really matter then if you bounced a wheel on the grass. It didn't matter. Because when you get back to the ship, of course, there aren't any wheels to bounce. Very often, mid-Atlantic, we took the wheels off to save weight. So I had that training, and then was sent to Speke, where the RAF had their merchant fighter unit, where again there was a catapult on the grass aerodrome, so if you bounced the wheels, it didn't matter. But they were rockets, actual rockets, and that was a big blast. And I can remember going one flight, one launch only, that's all they gave you, but it all was necessary, just so you had the experience of being launched by a rocket. And I can remember I was told, don't watch anybody else launch, it'll put you off. And but when I got out of the taxi or whatever it was at the aerodrome, I was walking to the mess to have lunch, and one was launched, and bloody hell, all the smoke and noise and thunder, it was off-putting, you know, to all that power being released just to get the aeroplane. And my launch was in the afternoon, but I really ought not to have witnessed that or heard that one. I would have been better going off unaware.
Obviously, you did your first training with the swordfish,
and then with a hurricane. Yeah.
What's the sensation like of being shot off the catapult? What was it like, say, with the swordfish?
Well, when you prepare yourself, you see, you first of all sit in the cockpit, and then there's a launching officer who you can see down to your left, and he's got a flag, a blue flag. And when he waves it like that, it means start up your engine and up to full revs. So you push the throttle open wide, tighten the grub screw, as it were, so it won't come back with the G-force. Put each elbow in your stomach, one hand on the stick, one hand on the throttle, put your head back, and then up with your arm and down. That means you're ready, and the launcher presses the button, so you go. And you get a right wallop in your back and and then you fly. That's all. When it gets to be the rocket catapult, it's just the same, except it's a bigger wallop. And you're blacked out. What it does, it drains the blood from the back of your eye, I think. So you black out. But it's only temporary. What, 1.5 seconds maybe? So when you get your vision back, you're flying. And you don't hear any noise. You're ahead of the sound. You don't have, and you don't see any of the flame and shit coming out the back. It's all behind you.
Was anybody injured during this training? Obviously, because it seems like...
I don't think so. I've never heard of anybody being injured, no.
Obviously, though, was that the first time you'd flown a swordfish as well, when you did the first part of the...
Yeah. Yes, I got about 5 minutes in my logbook, swordfish, and that was it. Off a catapult and land. Just a circuit land, that's all.
What did that feel like to fly after flying hurricanes?
Well, a swordfish is only a glorified tiger moth. It's a biplane. It's wooden fabric, you know, lightweight, fixed undercarriage, a joy to fly. If you ever interview a swordfish pilot, he'll tell you what a wonderful aeroplane it was.
So, once you've done your training, did you return to Belfast at that point?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was only a one-day job. Just sent to Belfast, do a launch, then come back. And then you're in the squadron, waiting for your number to be called for the next crewing, the next sailing of the Maprin, the camp ship, with the next convoy. That's the only time you get any flying. And I did a lot of flying over Strangford Loch and Belfast with the other members of the squadron, notably Bob Everett. Bob Everett, as I've said before, was 40. He was an old man, but exactly twice my age. Nice chap, though. He won the Grand National in 1929 at odds of 100-1 on a horse called Gregorlach. Now, that's a long time ago, but I shall never forget that. And he was a rough South African type. They'd spent a lot of time in South Africa. But a good mate to have. I can remember him taking me ashore. I'm using the word ashore in a naval way. We were already ashore, but it means going out of the air station into the city of Belfast to the Grand Central Hotel there. And sitting at the bar was the Marchioness of Dufferin and Arva. And she was obviously pregnant. And they walked up to her and said, "Another scone in the oven, lady?" And I was mortified, you know. But, of course, he'd be a jockey for her. He'd have ridden her horses. And they were, you know, on familiar terms. But he was a rough diamond, but a wonderful pilot. And his sad end was awful. He was the first man ever to shoot a Focke-Wulf Connor down from a cam ship. And he landed in the sea ahead of a ship of the convoy afterwards, and he got away with it. He told me it was dark green by the time he got out, but he got away with it. And that was the way it would go. But then I'd been up in an aeroplane. Actually, I'd been rocketed off the ship in harbour to recover the aeroplane for servicing, you see. And when I got back and landed, there was something wrong with the engine. I thought it was a spark plug misfiring or something. And Bob tests for it to see, and he says, "There's more than a spark plug. This is a rope engine. We need it to change the aircraft for the next convoy." And so he was to fly the airplane back to Yeovilton, right the way across in Somerset from Belfast, and bring a replacement. And over the Bay of Anglesey, somehow, the engine must have seized up. And it was dead stick. It was out without an engine. And we think that what he'd tried to do was stretch his glide onto the beach so he could land on the beach. But anyway, he didn't. And because he'd ditched before successfully, he ditched again, but he was round and he lost his life. And thereafter, we all said, "A hurricane, you see, it's got an oil cooler underneath, and that acts as a water scoop if you're landing, and turns it over." And so all said, "If we're not going to bail out, we're not going to ditch again, we'll bail out." And in fact, from then on, bailing out rather than ditching became the order of the day.
Who were the other members of the squadron at that time? Because you said it was quite a small group, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, well, there was... Minnie Marsh was a CO, a Royal Marine, a captain in the Marines. He was a CO. Bob Everett was number one pilot. Then there was Johnny Scott and Jimmy Clark and Benji Mankus and me. That's about it.
What were they all like? What were the different characteristics of these people you flew with?
Well, Johnny Scott. Of course, he became mates as well as contemporaries. A brilliant artist, Johnny Scott. Some of his work is hanging in the Alton Museum. And in fact, I'll show you, I've got here some of his works. A wonderful artist. The Slate School of Art before the war. Brilliant pilot. And he eventually was the personnel officer of British Aerospace, I think. I remember seeing him suddenly on Jimmy Can Fix It on TV one Saturday night. I said, "Bloody hell, there's Johnny Scott there." And he was fixing it for somebody to see a wind tunnel or something like that. Jimmy Clark, who, all these are dead now, of course. He was spent his life after the war in Rhodesia and was ruined economically because of the condition of, the countries, you know, now Zimbabwe, came back to England, had to begin again. Benji Mankus, a great mate, a Jew, and he became test pilot after the war for Bolton Paul. You remember Bolton Paul Defence? And he used to hurtle down Farnborough in these V things that were developing the V wing. Last time I spoke to him, he'd got ME disease, wasting of the muscles, and the apprentices that Bolton Paul had made him a wheelchair that he could steer just by twitching a muscle. But it got so severe he was in bed, and by arrangement I telephoned him, and his wife put the telephone on his pillow And all we talked about was Mappin back in the war. And he died within a week or two after that. A terrible end to a very fit, well, a mate. As I've mentioned, Bob, well, that's about it. We're such a small group of us.
Was Winkle Brown with you at the time?
Well, Winkle Brown joined 804, but never stayed with it. Winkle Brown, of course, became... He's still alive. He became a brilliant test pilot. Brilliant. My first knowledge of Winkle Brown was when I got to Sydenham in Belfast. He was leaving. I think I'd been on a visit. I think his appointment to 804 never really matured. I don't know. I don't think he ever went to sea with 804. But he took off, and immediately from the deck, he did a slow roll in American. I thought, hell's bells. And it was Winkle Brown.
You mentioned there that you decided to bail out, obviously, after the problems with the
with ditching.
Ditching. Did you work out a kind of technique for how you would bail out with the convoys?
Well, Johnny Walker did. He was the first to attack another Focke-Wulf Condor from Maplin, from the ship. And when he'd seen the Focke-Wulf going away, trailing a lot of smoke into a cloud, it probably was a down, but he couldn't be certain. He didn't see it go to the sea, but he had probably crippled it completely. He took his time, and I remember him telling me afterwards, he had plenty of petrol as he left. He just mooched about a bit and then got ahead of the convoy and then went into first of all, jettisoned the hood, the sliding hood of the cockpit. You could pull two levers and it blew off, jetted it altogether. Then he slackened his sudden harness, all his belts, straps across his belly and legs and shoulders. So he was absolutely free. And then he crouched on the cockpit seat, took his feet off the rudders, so he was crouching on the cockpit seat with his parachute and everything, and put the aeroplane into a slow roll, gently, just slow, slow roll. And when it was inverted, he pushed the stick forward, which meant the aeroplane was going up, and he cleared the cockpit so he didn't hit the tailplane. And he said, it was clean as a whistle, and of course it all goes quiet suddenly. And then his parachute opened, and in his hand he still had the brass D-ring that you pull to release the drag of the parachute, and it was still in his hand. And so he just let it drop, and he saw it plummeting down to the sea. And immediately he threw up sick. It was the feeling of ultraphobia. That's the relation of height, you see. You're not aware of height unless it's connected with the ground, and to see that plummet in the sea, it made him vomit. Anyway, that was going to be... I never did anything of this.
Okay, so could you tell me about the first time you went on convoy protection duty aboard HMS Maplin and what occurred?
Well, I didn't do it. Remember, I was the junior pilot. Well, I was the last to join. And the ship had already done convoy work. So it was getting near the end, or in other words, near the time that America was coming into the war, and therefore nearer the end of the need of camp ships. But I did about three convoys, I think. And a convoy, what we did was escort a convoy going outbound from England, if it were going to, let's say, America, halfway across the Atlantic, then meet an inbound convoy to escort it back in again. It didn't matter after a certain longitude, because then it became out of range, the convoy, out of range of the Focke-Wulf Condors, which were based at Bordeaux. So it were only protecting against aircraft operating from Europe. Otherwise, we'd escort convoys round the North Cape, Murmansk, the Russia convoy. Because there, of course, were based at Norway, protecting from enemy aircraft, or down to Gib. So I didn't do many convoys, and I did none of this blood and glory stuff at all. The only time, well, I don't know what sort of language I can hear. The only time I shit myself, I was once sitting in the cockpit, I better go back. The routine was that we never flew at night, never launched at night. There was no point, you couldn't see the enemy. So it was just day. And during the day, we took shifts of sitting in the cockpit for 2 hours so that we were ready to go at a moment's notice, warming the engine up every 20 minutes so the engine was warmed up. And we sat in the cockpit. There would be, in the ship, two aeroplanes, one on the catapult, but there was another one abaft the mainmast in reach of the crane, so if the first was fired off, it could crane the second aeroplane onto the catapult. So its complement was two aeroplanes. Sometimes there were two pilots crewing the ship, sometimes three. If, for instance, there was a launch, one pilot has gone anyway, so you've only two pilots left. And two pilots then could take it in turns, 2 hours apiece, through daylight hours, sitting in the cockpit. Well, my first panic was I was on duty sitting in the cockpit, and there's no signalling, verbal signalling, but you have a launching officer who was making gestulations at you. Start up, there's a panic, you see, so you start up. And I'm preparing then and going through the routine of a launch. You'll see at the back of that little essay I did, there's a notice that I preserved, I don't know how I did it, for all these years, that I put up in the crew room, procedure for a launch. And for the crew, the ground crew, what to do to prepare the aircraft and everything about it. And I was sitting there and ready to launch when the launching officer crossed his arms, which means shut down. So I closed down, and it turned out, I didn't know at the time, it turned out later that it was probably a Hudson of Coastal Command was ranging out in the Atlantic. A friendly aeroplane, in other words, not a German at all. False alarm. So shut down. If I'd been fired off, I'd probably have shot the Hudson down. You're so geared up, you know, it's an enemy. You can't think, shall I make sure it's an enemy? But anyway, that happened often. That friendly aeroplane was shot down very often. It was a case not in the Mediterranean later on. But I was shot down. And so you go through all the routine then of securing the aeroplane, taking out pins and things like that. And it was found that the main locking pin in the trolley on which the aeroplane was mounted was still in. And if I had been fired off, the aeroplane couldn't go anywhere. But 15 rockets would have gone and I'd have been cremated. And I wasn't told this. I didn't know where this until I'd got out of the cockpit and going up to the bridge. And, I believe them telling me I was, where is he? I'm going to hit this man. Whose responsibility to pull that thing out? He was put in a disciplinary charge. I don't know what he got, but it could have been the end of me. That's another of my nine lives. So that was one adrenaline rush. The other time, we were within what they call the Western Approaches, and an enemy aircraft on radar was detected again. And Benji Mankus was my number two, and he was on the bridge. And it was a question of usual routine, full revs with the engine, lock everything, elbows in the stomach, head back, and I was launched. But suddenly in my earphones of Benji Mankus shouting, "Breakaway, breakaway!" It recognised that the aeroplane wasn't a German at all. It was a Southern Era, which was a neutral country, a mail plane or something. He recognised it was not a bogey, an enemy. And I was launched in the Western Approaches. But I was in the Western Approaches and I had a full tank of petrol and we'd do the wheels back on because we were in each land. And so Benji gave me a course to steer. He says you have plenty of fuel. And I flew to Eglinton in Northern Ireland and landed. So I really didn't, you know, I never fulfilled the function of a catfighter.